Hello, Austin. Good morning.
Good morning.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here. I love coming to Austin. Who here is from Austin? I mean, nice. Excellent. I like your town a lot. I've been here many times, but usually it's when South by Southwest is on, so that doesn't really count, right? So I'm very happy to be here when when South by Southwest isn't on, so I get to actually go to all the places I want to go to. Anyway, so today I want to talk to you about the web because I'm a big fan. I like the web a lot. This wonderful, giant, big, huge mess, sprawling mess of a web, this beautiful, chaotic thing. It's almost too much to grasp, I think, just sheer scale of it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to just zoom in on one particular website to try and talk about the web in general by focusing in on one website in particular. And this website we're going to look at, it's made up of a number of formats, like most websites are, right? Number of different files, and those files are different formats. And some of these formats will be familiar to you. Some of them may be less familiar. But what's interesting about all of these particular formats is that these are all text formats, right? They're not binary formats. They're made of text, human-readable text files. And if we're going to look at text files on the web, I think it's interesting to look at where text came from, as in text that we use to communicate with. And text really started here with cuneiform clay tablets, these scratches and markings. These are maybe about 4,000 years old. If you ever get a chance to see these, they're beautifully intricate. They're quite small. The Pergamon Museum in Berlin has a wonderful collection. But, you know, quite different from any text we would use today. But this evolved. You know, we got hieratic text, which is later demotic, and that led to Greek. And you can see how, as it evolves, it starts to get closer to the text that we would recognize today. We start to get closer to the letter forms that we would use for the Western alphabet, for example, in these kind of texts. So this is something from about 330 AD. And at this point, knowledge is being stored in texts. And this is the amazing thing about texts. It's kind of the next step on from language. Language is amazing because it allows us to communicate ideas from brain to brain, right? It's just this way that I have an idea in my head, and by flapping the meat in my mouth and passing air over my vocal cords, I can vibrate the air. And as long as you can decode the format that I'm speaking in this case, English, then I can get an idea from my brain into your brain. That's pretty remarkable. And what text allows us to do is to do that over time. So I can get an idea out from my brain onto a text format. And then you could come along, read that text format. Again, once you can decode it, once you can decode the code base, in this case it would be English again, you could get that idea transferred to your brain, but the difference being that you could be reading this months, years, decades, or centuries after it was written. Right? And this allows us to store and pass on ideas over time, which is remarkable. So about this time, ideas are being stored in texts, and the texts themselves are being stored in these remarkable repositories of information, like, for example, the Library of Alexandria, which is where a lot of the world's knowledge was stored. Libraries, wonderful things, right up there with the web and things I am a fan of. But the Library of Alexandria is most famous for one thing, and it's not so much the texts that were stored there, it's famous for the fact that it burned down. We're not even clear exactly when it burned down, maybe around 391 AD, who knows? The fact that it's famous for being destroyed means all the knowledge about it is also destroyed, but we don't know what was stored there. We don't know how much knowledge was lost to humankind, whether if the Library of Alexandria still existed, would we have colonies on Mars at this point? Who knows? That timeline was shut off to us. It was a pretty bad time for knowledge, for text files, for Europe in general. Although, off the western coast of Ireland, off the western coast of Europe, Ireland was where some monks were starting to sort of store knowledge, store some of these text files, mostly because it was just such an inaccessible place that, you know, marauding hordes are unlikely to visit. This has been written about and talked about, and maybe over-exaggerated. There was a book called How the Irish Saved Civilization by Thomas Cahill, which may have exaggerated the point. But still, what did get saved tended to get saved here on the western coast of Europe. Now, Ireland itself suffered its own problems centuries later. In the mid-19th century was the Irish famine, which was an absolutely devastating effect. It's about 1846, 1847. Millions died, and millions also left the country, right, to start this exodus, which never really stopped. The population of Ireland has been decreasing since the middle of the 19th century. It's one of the few countries in Europe where the net population has been a loss. As you know, they all come here, right? They come to America, they go to other countries. But, you know, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, Chicago, these kind of places is where the Irish ended up coming. Like this guy, this is Francis O'Neill. And he comes from County Cork, which is where I'm from as well. He was born sort of the same time as the famine was going on, 1848. And like many others, he left the country later. He had all sorts of adventures. He was shipwrecked, traveled across the Wild West before settling in Chicago. And it was in Chicago that he became chief of police. He was also a fan of traditional Irish music. And I can kind of relate to this, that maybe he wasn't so much a fan when he was back in Ireland, but once you leave the country, suddenly you're like the most Irish person ever, right? You know what I'm talking about, Boston. He wanted to capture some of the Irish music. So what he ended up doing was, if you were in Chicago around this time in the 19th century, and you could play like the pipes or flute or fiddle, you're pretty much guaranteed a job on the Chicago police force. You know the cliched old movies where, it's always the Irish coppers on the beat. There's actually some truth to that. Like it was pretty much entirely made up of Irish policemen. So he started, he didn't play music himself, but he started transcribing the tunes that these musicians / police officers would play to him. And he collected these tunes. He collected them into a book, O'Neill's 1001, Jigs, Reels, Hornpipes, right? The dance music of Ireland. This was published about the start of the 20th century. And I remember when I was learning Irish music, this book was still very much the place you go to find sheet music for tunes. In fact, we just called it the book. Like if somebody played a tune and you wanted to learn it, you might ask, is that tune in the book? And they would know what you mean. You meant this book, right? So what ended up happening was actually back home in Ireland, the music was kind of dying out because people were leaving the country. And the fact that the knowledge got stored in this book meant that the music could be revived, right? Because it had been noted down. It contributed to a revival. Now, of course, the music was stored in sheet music, which is an interesting format because it's not exactly text format. I mean, it's a symbolic set in the same way as the alphabet is, but it's kind of more like a graphic than a text format, I think. I kind of picture it that way. So this is how sheet music looks, right? Which has its own history of being noted down, goes back to, medieval times, essentially. There was an interesting development with the transmission of music when the internet came along, or when the web came along. But even before that, email lists, bulletin boards, people want to transfer music, right, from one computer to another. But you can't send an image file. That's going to be way too big. You can't send, certainly can't send an audio file, even a MIDI file. That's still way too big to be sending over the kind of networks we had back then, modems, right, really slow dial-up. So there was this new format that was created in 1991 by John Chambers, and it's called ABC, where it is purely text, which is really nice and lightweight and cheap to send. And you can see it's kind of, it's almost JSON-like to begin with the metadata, what's the title of the tune, information about how it should be played. And then the notes themselves are literally just letters of the alphabet, like any other text format. It's reusing the Western alphabet, where lowercase and uppercase mean different octaves. We've got things like the vertical pipe symbol to make, to note bar lines. So I'll try and demonstrate what this tune is that we're looking at here, if you'll bear with me. Let's see. So this is Chief O'Neill's favorite. So that's a hornpipe. Thank you. Thank you very much. That's a hornpipe. And all the information encoded into, the notes of the tune, at least, maybe not the nuances of how it would be played, but is encoded into this text file, which is pretty remarkable. So what you could do in the over email lists, bulletin boards, and then later the web, was you could transmit just text files like this, and the person at the other end could unpack that, could decode it, either by looking directly at it or using software on their machine that could convert the ABC file into sheet music, or maybe even a MIDI file, right? So when I was first getting into the web, I was living in Germany in the 90s, and like I was saying, it's once you leave Ireland that you start to get really into the, you know, oh, I'm so Irish. So I'm getting really into Irish folk music because I'm not living in Ireland anymore. And I decided I wanted to put together a site about Irish music with tunes. So I made the site called thesession.org. And the idea would be that I would put on a tune every week in ABC format, but also convert it to sheet music and so on. So I launched it in, gosh, 98, 97, I can't remember. And initially it looked like this. Please, you know, forgive me. This is like 15 years old now. And it was nice. And I actually started to get a bit of a following because it had this weekly structure, this weekly release cycle. Of course, there was an issue here, and that was with scaling it, because I'm putting out a tune every week, but there's only so many tunes I know. So eventually I hit that wall of like, well, that's it. I've run out of tunes I know. So I decided I was going to completely revamp the site to make it much more of a write-read kind of site where people could contribute tunes in ABC format and other things like the location of Irish music events or sessions and recordings and stuff. So I relaunched the site in 2001 as much more of a community site, right, where everything was being contributed by the people. So people could contribute tunes in ABC format, and then I would convert it into sheet music. So I was a bit of a bottleneck there. I was doing it manually. Every time somebody contributed a tune, I had to convert it. So I was really pleased with this site initially. I was really, really proud of it because it was really becoming the go-to place on the web for Irish music. But like I said, that was 2001. And I kind of let it stagnate, which is a real shame. As browsers evolved and the web evolved, there's so much more I could have been doing with the site, and I wasn't doing it. And the session was simultaneously my proudest achievement and my most shameful achievement, because I was like, oh, it could have been so much better. So for years, I was saying, I really need to relaunch the session, need to revamp it. But it was this huge monolithic task. I really wasn't looking forward to it. I think, like, for 2 years running on my New Year's resolution, I had, you know, relaunch the session. But I finally got around to it last year. So this is after 10 years of the previous design, the previous, you know, way that things got done, I relaunched the site. And this is the site I wanted to look at, is how I approached that from a long-term view, as in, it's a site that's been online for over a decade. It's a site that will be online for, hopefully, much longer than a decade. And how I evaluated technologies and how I evaluated approaches to building a site for the long term, not just for the here and now. Of course, one of the things, when you're building a website today, that's clear is that I can no longer rely on the fact that somebody's just going to be looking at it on a desktop or a laptop computer, right? Which would have been a safe bet maybe 10 years ago. Because these days, of course, the site has got to go everywhere, because people will use whatever device they have to hand to view the site, to use the site. Exactly what Karen was talking about yesterday, right? Luckily, I've got a whole bunch of devices I can test on, because at Clear Left we got this device lab, which I was able to use to do some testing, which is really handy. Just tell you about this device lab. Also, it's open to the public. Anybody can come by and test on these devices. So we're in Brighton in the UK. And this started because there were some friends of mine in Portland had this idea that they were going to have this open device lab where people could come and use it. And I thought, that is a great idea. And every time I saw them, I'd say to them, oh, how's the open device lab thing going? And they'd say, great, we just signed the paperwork to get founded as a nonprofit. And the next, we're sending our lawyer to do this. And I was like, ugh, it's never going to actually launch, is it? So at Clear Left, I was gathering together a few devices, like a handful of crappy devices from secondhand shops. And I had them on a table for testing responsive designs with. But I felt really bad that they were just sitting on the table most of the time, not being used. It feels wasteful. And I thought of the idea of the Open Device Lab, and I thought, yeah, they had all that paperwork to do and all the insurance stuff I guess we'd have to cover. And I thought, you know what, screw it. So I wrote a blog post, and I tweeted out, and I said, hey, anybody in Brighton who wants to come and use these devices, help yourself. I didn't worry about insurance. I didn't worry about liability, any of that. I just did it. And what I didn't expect was that straight away, other designers and developers in Brighton responded with tweets like, oh, I've got this phone lying on my desk and I feel really bad about it lying there. Do you want to take it? Or I've got a phone in a drawer that's just sitting there gathering dust. Can I bring it by and drop it off? And I was like, hell yeah. So within 24 hours, the number of devices had doubled. And since then, we've got like 40, 50 devices there. Hardly any of them are actually mine. They've all been contributed by other people. And this idea of an open device lab has taken off. So if you go to opendevicelab.com, you can find out if there's an open device lab near you where you can come by and test on devices. And if there isn't, you can get advice on starting one, which I highly recommend you do. But so this is really handy these days. You're trying to test your work on so many different devices. And I will point out, this is testing, not optimizing. It's not like I'm trying to optimize for every possible device. That doesn't scale. But testing on every device. So it was clear, relaunching a website today as opposed to 10 years ago, I'm going to go mobile first. I'm sure you've all, who's read the book by Luke, Mobile First, right? Great book, excellent. And of course, one of the things he talks about is the fact that by going mobile first, you have to prioritize. You have to be pretty ruthless about figuring out what's the most important thing on this page. And so for me, the mobile first is kind of you follow its conclusion. It's content first. It's figuring out what's most important. And when I say content, I don't necessarily mean copy or images. Just as Luke was saying, this is about tasks. The content could be adding something to a shopping cart. The content could be very much actions as opposed to consuming. And if you really want to take this content first approach to its ultimate limit, something I like to do, if I ever get the chance to do this on projects, is I like to start with the URLs. Like really bring it down to the most basic webbiness of what you're building is what is the URL structure, which is something I think people don't think about enough. And yet URLs are so, so important. Some people treat them as like an implementation detail of the web. Like, oh yeah, we got native, we got the web, web has URLs, whatever. Whereas I think it's the most powerful part of the web. In fact, once you have the name of something, once you have the address, that you can pull that up on any device as long as it's connected to a network, that is amazing. That immediately makes it part of this huge, big, chaotic mess of a web. It was Tim Berners-Lee who said, when you have a URL, it's part of the web, it's part of the discourse of humanity, right? This giant library of Alexandria that we're all collectively building. So this URL design as a skill is something I feel we're kind of losing, which is a real shame because I think it's, I will admit, I'm a URL fetishist, okay? I love a good URL. But I think rightly so, because they are this fundamental unit of the web. And Kyle Neath, who works at GitHub, where they have beautiful URLs, he said, URLs are universal. They work in Firefox, Chrome, Safari, Internet Explorer, curl, wget, your iPhone, Android, and even written down on sticky notes. They are the one universal syntax of the web. And that's so important to remember, right? Written down on sticky notes, written on a poster. They're for humans. URLs are for humans. Yes, they're used by machines to like fetch a resource, but they're very much for humans. URLs should be hackable, guessable, readable, right? So on the session, I've got this kind of structure with my URLs where you could, sort of restful, you can drill down, and this is repeated throughout the site, this URL structure. And in a way, this is kind of like, almost like an API for the content. The content just happens to be in HTML format. In fact, there is a read-only API for the session, and rather than have it at a separate subdomain or a completely different URL, the API is these same URLs, just adding on a query string to say, I'll take this in RSS, or I'll take this in JSON, right? So thinking about your content that way, almost like an API-first approach, is really good for stopping yourself thinking too much about the appearance, thinking about how things are going to look, where things are positioned, right? This idea of content first. Literally the content, devoid of where it's going to appear, whether it's even going to be showing up on a visual medium at all, right? And something else I do to kind of drive home the content-first approach is to try and break things down into their fundamental units. Instead of thinking about layout and how things fit together, which is important, but I feel like that kind of needs to come later, I try to break things down into the building blocks. And I do this at work, but I decided to also do this on a personal project like the session. So here I've broken things down into, we got buttons, we got feedback messages, form fields, you know, headings, all this kind of stuff, breaking it down into individual units. And I have this one document where you've got, this is what the unit looks like, and here's the markup that's generating that pattern. And I've thrown this up on GitHub. I call it a pattern primer. It's just a little PHP script that looks in a folder full of little HTML snippets. It's been ported to Ruby and Python and other languages too, so go ahead and take it, use it, whatever you like. I just find this so useful to think in terms of the building blocks rather than thinking of the whole picture to start with, because then you tend to have more robust units. And it forces you in your CSS as well to not rely on context when you don't know whether a building block is going to appear in the main column or a sidebar or what that even means these days, right? And there's a corollary to the content-first approach, which is navigation second, right? If you're going to have your content first, navigation second. And again, this is an idea that I first saw from Luke. When his previous startup, BagCheck, he had this content first, navigation second approach. And I've shamelessly ripped it off for the session. So on the session, you can see there's this trigger at the top, and that brings up the navigation. And the way it's working is that trigger, that little downward arrow, is a hyperlink. That's all it is. It's a hyperlink pointing to a fragment identifier that's at the bottom of the page, which is the navigation. And the back to top link is just another hyperlink. And a great thing about this pattern is that this will work everywhere, and I mean everywhere. Any browser connected to the internet understands hyperlinks. So it's a very robust pattern. And you can still, there's all sorts of other patterns you can use, right? Off canvas and you know, overlays and progressive disclosure. And the nice thing about this is you could start with this as your baseline, as your default, and enhance up to using any of those other patterns. But if anything ever goes wrong, you've got this great fallback, which is this content first, navigation second approach I really like. And of course, once we get more screen real estate to play with, I can start putting the navigation further up, right? I can put it back up to the top of the page. Using CSS, right, we got absolute positioning, we got display table, we got flexbox, we got all sorts of ways that we can now move things around regardless of their source order, right? CSS has gotten really good at that. Oh, you notice one of the other things that changed as I got more real estate. It wasn't just that the navigation was changing, but the logo as well, right? The logo starts being this kind of strip and then becomes more like this tag off to the side. I'm not swapping out images there because the logo is actually just text. It's just CSS and markup, which is obviously, you know, nice and lightweight, and CSS is great. And of course, not every browser is going to get these styles. You know what? I'm fine with that. That's okay, it's an enhancement. And something else I wanted to make sure I really got right for the session, because as I said, everything on the session these days is contributed by somebody else, right? It's not me putting the content in, it's somebody else. I wanted to make sure that input was as good as I could get it. And it could be better. I think there's always room for improvement. But I'd learned a few things from previous work I'd done that I decided I'd try and apply. So, there's this site, Huffduffer, that Jeffrey mentioned that I built a few years back. And on Huffduffer, on the login, I provided a little toggle you can see there to show your password, right? So it's input type equals password, but if you click the checkbox, then you can reveal the password so you can see what you're typing. Just a little usability enhancement, the same way that works on operating systems, right? When you're connecting to Wi-Fi and stuff like that. Nice little pattern. That was a few years ago, and for the session, I decided I was actually going to reverse it. I decided I would make the password or field input type equals text by default, and if you want to hide it, then you have to tick the box. Now, I knew this was going to be interesting from a psychological perspective, how people would react to this. But honestly, I believe the whole input type equals password thing with the dots where you're obscuring what's written, it's security theater. I don't think it's helping anyone. I mean, when you've been like typing in like that, people looking over your shoulder. And also, if you are worried about that, I've got the toggle. So I put this out there, and I did receive emails from people saying, oh, you've got the password in a input type equals text. You shouldn't do that. And I responded genuinely curious. I was like, oh, why not? I really wanted to know. Like, please tell me, why not? And nobody could tell me why not. All they could say was, no other site does that. I was like, yeah, I know that, but why not? Why shouldn't I do this? And they brought up situations like, oh, somebody could be looking over my shoulder. I'm like, yes, that's why I provided the toggle, right? So there was a little bit of pushback, but on the whole, not that much. And let's face it, this makes it a heck of a lot easier to input something on a mobile device, right? Which is very much something where you're not going to have people looking over your shoulder. And heck, if they are, there's the toggle. So I think this is going to take a while to percolate, but I think we will drop the security theater of obscuring inputs, which gives this illusion of security that isn't there. I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on that, whether I've pushed it too far. But I think that the time is right. The world is ready for this. And as well as input type equals text and password and all that stuff, I'm going crazy with all these great new input types we've got now with HTML5, right? These are wonderful. The great thing about all of these is that, you know, if you use these, you might get rewarded in the browsers that understand these. But if this is read by a browser that doesn't understand them, that's absolutely fine. They will just use these as input type equals text. Because of the way the HTML works, right? It's like, if you type input type equals foo or input type equals bar, a browser will see that and go, I don't understand that. I'm defaulting to input type equals text, which is great. It means we can start using the new shiny stuff safe in the knowledge that it's not going to break in older browsers. So I can use input type equals number. It's going to just be like input type equals text for older browsers. But on newer browsers that understand it, they'll use that. Like on an iOS device, you get this keypad that's got the numbers already displayed with the symbols and stuff. It's not quite a numeric keypad, because input type equals number can still accept commas. It can accept decimal points and stuff. If you want a numeric keypad, there is an attribute called input mode. And you can specify that this should be a numeric input mode. This is not supported yet in any browsers. This is in HTML5, but it's not supported yet. But it's on the way. So you can just start adding this stuff now. Because again, the way the browsers work is they see something they don't understand, like an attribute like this. They just ignore it. So it's like you're putting something in there for future browsers. Also, we do have a little hack we can use today if you want to get the same effect, which is you can use the pattern attribute. Using the pattern attribute, what you do is you provide a regular expression. Now you've got two problems, which specifies what you expect from the input. In this case, I'm saying I only want numbers here. Be careful with this, because think about whether your input truly is just numbers. Because a lot of things that look like numbers that actually take commas and decimal points or spaces, right? So think about that, or minus signs, things like that. But if you truly only need the numbers 0 to 9, then go ahead and use this pattern 0 to 9, and you'll get that numeric keypad, because iOS is smart enough to realize it doesn't need to use one of the other keyboards. So that's handy. One of the other new things in HTML5 that I've decided to use on the session is the data list element, which I really like. I don't see that many people using it yet, but I really, really like it. So this is a way of turning a regular input into a combo box, which is like a cross between a text input and a select, right? So somebody can type into the text, but if they start typing something that's in this list of options, then that will come up like an autocomplete sort of suggestion, right? So you've got a regular input, and you've got this list attribute that points to an ID. The ID is on the data list element. And then you've got a bunch of options, and it's the value in the options that count. So as the user is typing in, what they get is the ability to choose from the selection. Or if what they're typing isn't in the selection, they can just keep on typing, OK? So this is perfect for those situations. You've got like, let's take an example, like, how did you hear about us? And it's a select list. And then after that, the last one in the select list is other. And then the next form field is, if other, please specify. And then you've got a text field, right? This is if other, please specify. This is perfect. You're giving them a choice, but also giving them the option to type whatever they want. Really, really handy little pattern using the data list element. And another attribute we can use these days is placeholder. Again, something like data list we could do before, but it required JavaScript, probably a jQuery plugin, right? That's more stuff to download. Same with this placeholder pattern, where when there's nothing in the form field, you want some kind of grayed out text that shows an example of the input that is expected, right? We could do this using JavaScript. Now we can do it in HTML. We just say, here's the placeholder text. And I know this, for anything that's using the data list element, because the options in the data list are effectively possible inputs, and what you're supposed to put into the placeholder is a possible input, then any element that has a data list associated, you could programmatically just grab any one of those and put it in there as placeholder. So that's what I've done there. It just grabs one of randomly grabs one of those suggestions and puts it in as the placeholder text into the input. And I've put that JavaScript up online as well. So feel free to grab that and drop it into your site, and it'll just work straight away. It won't work in every browser, right? Not every browser supports data list. Not every browser supports placeholder. You know what? That's absolutely fine. Because the core content here, the task, is inputting something and hitting that button and going to the next screen, right? And none of this affects that other than to make it a bit better, to enhance it, right? And this is the approach I've been taking with the session. It's the approach I've been taking online for as long as I've been making websites, this idea of progressive enhancement. There's some myths about progressive enhancement. I think there's this idea that progressive enhancement means designing for the lowest common denominator, which isn't true. Progressive enhancement is about starting from the lowest common denominator and then building up. But there's no limit to where you can go. So the idea is, progressive enhancement in a nutshell, the idea is you've got these layers of technology, and you begin with your HTML, okay? And you structure your HTML well, and it works as a standalone thing. The hyperlinks are proper hyperlinks. The forms work as forms. Then you can add your CSS, your enhancing using styles. And then you can add your JavaScript. Add in all sorts of WYSI goodness, that's great. But if the JavaScript fails or the CSS fails, that's fine. You've still got well-structured content, well-structured markup. But progressive enhancement goes further than that, because at each level, at each part of the stack, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, you can use progressive enhancement, right? So placeholder attribute, data list element, new input types, I can use those in HTML today as an enhancement, and that's great. That allows us to evolve the language. And the reason I can do that, as I said, is that browsers won't choke on that stuff. Older browsers won't throw an error. If a browser sees an element it doesn't recognize or an attribute it doesn't recognize, it doesn't halt parsing of the page and throw an error and say the user can't read the page. It just goes, eh, don't understand it, going to carry on. That's actually really, really powerful, that kind of error handling. It's the same with CSS. If a parser sees a selector it doesn't understand or a value or a property, it just moves on to the next one. That's enormously powerful, because that allows us to keep on expanding CSS. This is how we can keep adding stuff to CSS. You can start using the new stuff today, even when it's only in one or two browsers, because you're safe in the knowledge that no browser's going to choke on it. It's not going to break any other browser, right? Now, it's a bit different with JavaScript, because with JavaScript, if you use a property or a method that the browser doesn't understand, it will throw an error. It has a different error handling model. So you have to be a bit more careful in JavaScript and always test, do you understand this property, like geolocation or something, right? If so, do this stuff. But once you do that, you can apply progressive enhancement at the JavaScript level too. But that error handling of JavaScript can be tricky. So progressive enhancement, the idea is that it's about being robust. It's about, you know, catering for the situations you can't imagine where something goes wrong that you haven't foreseen. One of the descriptions that's always given of you know, what progressive enhancements, it's like escalators. They can never break, they can just become stairs, right? Although in this case, they clearly didn't get the memo, because I can't climb these now stairs. But it's kind of a good way of thinking about how we should use JavaScript. It's like electricity. It should be used to enhance things. So an escalator is an electric stairs, or a moving walkway is just a floor, right? How can a floor be out of service? A moving walkway is just a progressively enhanced floor, right? Or here we go. An electric toothbrush is just a progressively enhanced toothbrush, right? It doesn't break. It just goes back to being an old-fashioned toothbrush. So I think with JavaScript, that's definitely the way we should approach it. Enhancements. There's no limit to what we can do with JavaScript, but I think from a philosophical point of view, we need to treat it as a technology that's used to enhance what's already there, which is in the markup, right, which is where the content is. And yet, I see sites that use JavaScript for literally everything, for the markup, for the content, for the core tasks. They rely on JavaScript, which I think is dangerous. This is Squarespace if you have JavaScript turned off. You go to squarespace.com without JavaScript, this is what you get. The page has finished loading at this point. It's my Facebook stream without JavaScript. Nice big white blank expanse. Although they have a bug report for this saying, hey, what do I do when my homepage is blank? They've got a fix for that. It's turn on JavaScript. But this actually isn't the point. It isn't about people turning off JavaScript or browsers that don't support JavaScript. Frankly, it's actually getting harder and harder to switch off JavaScript in most browsers these days. That's not what progressive enhancement is about. It's about how you use the JavaScript you're using. It's not relying on the JavaScript. And you might think, well, look, I've looked at my audience. I know the kind of devices they're using. All these devices are JavaScript capable. It's like, yeah, but stuff happens that you can't predict. And progressive enhancement allows you to be ready for the unpredictable. As Scott Jale said, every user is a non-JavaScript user while a page is still loading. So you want to make sure your page works. Maybe it's not a great experience without JavaScript. That's fine, but as long as it works, and then you use JavaScript to make it a great experience. So this is the page for downloading Chrome from Google. I took this screenshot, I think it was last year. For 2 hours, nobody could download Chrome. It didn't work because there was an error in the JavaScript, in a big JavaScript file. And because of that error, that button didn't work. Because that button, it is a link, but that's the href value of the link. Instead of being a link to an actual file or a page or something, like a proper link, it's this JavaScript pseudo protocol. So effectively, it's not really a link at all. So because if there was one error completely unrelated somewhere in a JavaScript file, this link did not work as a link. And for 2 hours, nobody in the world could download Google Chrome. I'm pretty sure heads probably rolled for that one. My friend Andy Hume said, progressive enhancement is more about dealing with technology failing than dealing with technology not being supported. And I think that's very true, actually. Like I said, it's about preparing for the unexpected. Well, I see this kind of stuff all the time, this assumption that JavaScript will be available, this reliance on JavaScript, which, like I said, just from a purely engineering perspective, doesn't make sense because of the error handling in HTML and CSS. If you make a mistake in your HTML, the browser is going to be very forgiving. If you make a mistake in your CSS, the browser is going to be very forgiving, right? They just ignore stuff they don't understand. If you make a mistake in your JavaScript, the browser is not going to be forgiving. It will throw an error. It will stop the parsing at that point. So just from Occam's razor, from an engineering perspective, if you want a robust page, it makes sense not to rely on JavaScript. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying don't use JavaScript. I love JavaScript. It's just how you use it, how you deploy it as an enhancement, not this or this on Flickr, right? This JavaScript pseudo protocol, or this on Foursquare. It's not even a link or a button. It's a span, where they've got styles to make it look like a link, and they probably got JavaScript to make it act exactly like a link. Just use a link or a button. This stuff makes me angry. It really does. So on the session, I wanted to make sure I was using progressive enhancement. And probably the most complex part of the session now is converting the ABC to sheet music. As I said, I used to be the bottleneck there. I used to have to do this by hand. I wanted this to be automated. So by default, you've got your ABC file there, and there's a button to turn it into sheet music, and that is, a proper button inside a form. And by default, it just generates something on the server side. It generates a GIF. This is actually on a third-party server. I should really bring it in-house and do it on the session itself. But by default, without JavaScript, without any technology, this still works, right? And it will generate an image file like that. But if you have JavaScript available, then what I do is I kind of, capture that click on the button, and instead of going off to another page, we stay on the page we're on, we use a little bit of Ajax, and we bring in the sheet music into the page, right? So this is an enhancement. Everyone will be able to look at sheet music. It's just the experience is much nicer if you've got JavaScript and if you support the technologies. And one of the ways that this is much nicer, I think, is that this sheet music that's generated here isn't a GIF. This is SVG. So it's nice and crisp because some genius out there has written an ABC to SVG converter in JavaScript, which is just insane. The Atwood's law states that anything that can be written in JavaScript will be written in JavaScript. I think that's very true. Somebody has ported Unix to JavaScript. It's getting pretty crazy. But SVG, I love. I love SVG. It's so crisp. You can bump up the font size. It still stays crisp. Looking at any device, it's automatically responsive, right? It's like just fits the container. I'm using SVG somewhere else as well, actually, on the member profiles. I have these spark lines. I love spark lines. So spark lines, it's a term coined by Edward Tufte. And he describes them as a small, intense, simple, word-sized graphic with typographic resolution. And again, they're kind of an enhancement. The information is already there in text, and you just enhance it with this nice little visual enhancement with a sparkline, right? And I'd used sparklines before on Huffduffer. I was using sparklines. I was using Google Charts API, because you could use that API, like image source equals, and then you've got this Google Chart href, and you pass it all the parameters, and it could generate a chart for you, and it could generate a sparkline for you. It was a really, really useful service, really good API. So Google's shutting it down. Because that's what Google did. You know, when you've been making websites long enough, you learn to trust no one, especially when it comes to APIs being available. No, no, no. Over a long enough time scale, all APIs disappear. So I did not want to rely on any third-party service for this. So I thought, okay, I'll figure out how to make sparklines myself. I thought somebody must have done it, right? You know, looking on GitHub, I'm looking on Stack Overflow, and well, on Stack Overflow, of course, all the answers are use this jQuery plugin. Not knocking jQuery, but jQuery is kind of like the spam of Stack Overflow. If you're trying to solve any problem and you don't want to use jQuery, good luck. But I had to write it myself. So I wrote this little script that generates sparklines. It generates a little canvas element with sparkline. And I put it up on GitHub, and I wrote a blog post saying, here's this thing I wrote to make sparklines using canvas. But I finished the blog post by saying, this doesn't feel right. Like, I don't think canvas is the right element here, because you know, it's not a dynamic image. It's not going to move or anything. It's just staying still. And actually, SVG would be better. So if someone wanted to, you know, make an SVG version, that would be great. I swear to God, 2 hours later, somebody had converted it to SVG. I love the web. I love the fact that, you know, this kind of sharing and evolution I love that kind of stuff. And with GitHub now especially, you know, it makes sharing so much easier and people can improve other people's code. I love it. Anyway, somebody else has basically made a service out of this where you can just pass in the numbers and get back an SVG. So now I've got sparklines, nice and crisp, using SVG. And this is the crazy thing. Every sparkline, no matter how different it looks, is the same SVG file. And I just pass in different numbers. Right? Now, wait a minute. SVG, that's an image format, right? No, not quite. SVG is like simultaneously an image, which is the output you see, and text, because it's a markup document, right? It's a form of XML. You can view source in SVG. And because it's a markup document, that means you can put scripts inside the SVG file, which is what's happening here. It's looking at the query string, figuring out, yeah, it's like the script is coming from inside the SVG file. You could put style declarations inside SVG files. So, you know, I showed earlier how I made my logo look different at different sizes. I was using media queries there. But you could put media queries inside a style sheet inside an SVG file to make an automatically responsive logo or any other image that would respond to its containing element. SVG is awesome. I love it. Now, initially, when I was adding these sparklines to the member profiles, it was computationally kind of expensive, so it was kind of holding up the loading of the page. So I didn't download them initially. I waited till the page was loaded, and then I fired off a request using AJAX to grab those sparklines and put them into the page, because I wanted to get better performance. And this idea of having your core content loaded, and then you do some loading afterwards, you know, for the enhancements, for the nice-to-have stuff, it's this idea of conditional loading, where maybe you load in the stuff, maybe you won't, by doing a test in JavaScript. Conditional loading, I feel, is something, it's really, really important, especially for responsive design, and it doesn't get talked about enough, in my opinion. A lot of people kind of poo-poo responsive design because they make this mistake of thinking that you're serving up exactly the same thing to every browser. But using conditional loading, what you can do is serve up your core content to every browser, your basic core content. And then after the DOM is ready, then you can do some testing and say, OK, if the screen is wide enough for some other parameters, then I want to load in this other content as well. Not core content, but nice to have content. Like on the front page of the session, right? This is just the content. It's loaded in. It's grabbed from the server. But down at the bottom, you can see I've got links off to, you know, Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, because there's a Flickr pool of photos of Irish music and stuff. So after the page is already loaded, then I use some JavaScript and I say, you know what, if the screen is wider than a certain width, I've got enough room, let's pull in some of those photos. This is conditional loading, and then just display them in line. But it's not going to hold up the displaying of the page. This will happen after page load. The user can already carry on what they're doing, right? And in fact, this is kind of the perfect place to use conditional loading because it's third-party content. I'm not now relying on Flickr servers to be up all the time to render my page. If something goes wrong with a third-party service, that's OK. So a great place to use conditional loading is if you have those buttons somewhere, like saying, you know, like, or plus one, or tweet this, or follow me, all that kind of stuff. I mean, first of all, it makes you look really desperate. just saying. But secondly, you are relying on a third-party service for the rendering of your document. The way that most of those little widgets work is they say, oh, just insert this script element into the middle of your page, a script element which will block rendering until the source has been retrieved. So you might think, that's OK. Twitter's servers are always going to be up, right? All right? And then someone tries to look at your page in China, and your page never finishes loading because that script element never finishes loading because Twitter is blocked in China. That's just one example. But again, like I said, you've been in this business long enough, you get paranoid. You don't want to rely on a third-party service for anything. And conditional loading allows us to have the best of both worlds. Right? I'm going to get the value from these third-party services, but I'm not going to be reliant on them. Right? Conditional loading, really handy for that. To speed things up a little, when you know you're going to be making a request out to some other server, in the head, you can do a DNS prefetch. So this is a rel value in the link element, DNS prefetch. And then you point to the third-party service you're going to be using. And this is just a hint to the browser that you're going to be getting something from this domain, so you might want to do the DNS lookup for that domain when you've got a chance, right? When the browser's ready and has a moment. So there's a whole bunch of these kind of rel values that help you squeeze a little bit more performance from the browser. You can prefetch. If you're pretty sure that the user is going to go to a specific URL next, you're pretty confident about that, you can tell the browser that it might want to prefetch that page in the background when it's ready, when it's got time. It's not a command to the browser, it's a suggestion to the browser. It's still left at the discretion of the browser. And if you're very confident that the user is going to visit a particular page next, you can even use pre-render, though I would say be very careful with this one, right? Be careful, because that's a big assumption to be making. But it could result in very, very snappy loading in the browsers that support this, which I find myself like trying to squeeze every bit of performance out of the browsers. Like, the performance is so important. It always was. Performance always was important. But somehow we got lazy there for a while. Like, I remember back in my day, right in the 90s, We were making the smallest image files we possibly could. We only had 216 colors to work with. You tell that to the young people today, they wouldn't believe you. But we would keep our page sizes really low as well, right? Right? And these days, we got page sizes in the megabytes. What happened to us? Like, sometime in the last 10 years, a memo went around saying, everybody's on broadband now. Everybody's got great big monitors now. We do not have to worry about optimizing anything. It's all taken care of. Good job, guys. I missed that memo, right? And we all got really lazy. And thank heaven for responsive design and the rise of mobile and all these other devices. Because now they're like, oh, no, I have to optimize everything and make it really snappy. And he's like, hell yeah. You should have been doing that anyway, right? That was always a skill of being a web designer. And somehow we lost that skill, and now we're getting it back. Right? Now performance is so important. You can't ignore it. It's the single most important part of the user's experience. Like, if you are a UX designer and you're not thinking about performance, you're not doing your job. And I like the nerdiness of trying to squeeze every bit of performance out. I was really disappointed, actually. So Google PageSpeed have taken the score out of the reports they give you when you hit the PageSpeed thing. So I used to love trying to get that number as high as I could. It's gamification, I know. But I used to love trying to get the highest score I possibly could. Now they don't give you a score anymore. It's a shame. But still, performance. So I can't repeat it enough. And this is the interesting thing, is that with the time scales I'm concerned with here, with this website, which has been online for over a decade and is going to be online for much longer than that, I hope, I've got these two different time scales I'm looking at, which is decades, maybe even centuries. And then on the other end, nanoseconds, microseconds, the really, really short. How fast does this load? How quickly can the user accomplish their task? These two very different timescales, they're what interest me. And all the stuff in the middle, I kind of don't care about as much. Days, weeks, stuff, months. And yet in our work, those are the timescales we tend to concentrate on. When is this shipping? It's shipping next month. Right? When is the deadline? Get those files to me by Friday. These are the timescales we're thinking of. This website needs to be on by, you know, this particular date this year. We're thinking in pretty short timescales. And actually, if you want to think long term, if you really want to be prepared for what's coming, and we don't know what's coming, we don't know what kind of device is out there, then thinking in terms of the past can actually be your best bet. It's this idea of being future friendly, right? Trying to somehow prepare for the future. You can't be future proof. Nobody can predict the future. But there will be more variation in devices. There will be more variation in ways that people will be accessing your content, using your content. You can't predict that, but you can prepare for that. And the best way to be future friendly is to be backwards compatible. Right? To stick to those technologies, the robust technology, starting with well-formed markup, adding your CSS as an enhancement. Remember that every time you put a, you write a style declaration, you are not telling the browser what to do, you are suggesting something to the browser. It's important to remember that. And not relying on JavaScript or any other technology, not putting all your eggs in one basket, particularly a basket that has an error handling capability like JavaScript. So progressive enhancement is a way to be future friendly, in my opinion. And there are people thinking about the long-term view here, like the Long Now Foundation. Who's familiar with the Long Now Foundation? OK, one or two people. Any members of the Long Now Foundation here? OK, not too many. It's kind of an obscure thing, but they concentrate on long-term timescales. They have projects they're thinking in the hundreds and thousands of years. They're probably the most famous one is the Clock of the Long Now. This is a clock that will tell time for 10,000 years. It's a scale-free clock. It's being built inside a disused mine in Nevada. It's being built. This isn't like some theoretical thing. They're actually building something that's going to tell time for 10,000 years, which I really like, because it gets you thinking about those kind of timescales. It gets you thinking about the engineering problems. It gets you thinking about, you know, long-term problems. And looking at the web, and all these different formats, like I said at the start, that I'm using on this one particular website, they're text formats, so I think that increases their longevity, because binary formats tend to last for shorter periods of time. Image formats, video formats, right? Which concerns me a lot. We're putting so much of our collective culture up online in binary formats. Whether the JPEG format will still be supported in a few decades' time is not clear. And when it comes to video, yeah, it's even more of a mess. But text formats, because they're human readable, probably stand a better chance of surviving. Right? It's a slightly better. But the most important thing is to just be thinking about this stuff. And next time somebody says to you, the internet never forgets, just call bullshit on that. It's absolute bollocks. Look at the data. The internet forgets all the time. The average lifespan of a web page is months. And yet people are like, oh, you got to be careful what you put online. It'll be there forever. Facebook never forgets. Google never forgets. No, I would not entrust our collective culture, our society's memory, to some third-party servers we don't even know. Certainly not to the cloud, whatever that means, the cloud. What a bullshit term. I mean, it's just another word for somebody else's server. Next time somebody talks about the cloud, just substitute somebody else's server. It's on a hard drive somewhere. You know, what I do is I mentally substitute the word moon when someone says cloud, and it makes just as much sense, but it's way more entertaining. But like I said, just thinking about it, thinking about how long stuff is going to be online, thinking about what formats you're going to use. These formats, I don't know whether they'll last. You know, a lot of these formats will probably disappear. Although this one, I have high hopes for, HTML. Because they are thinking about the long-term picture when it comes to HTML. You know, when Tim Berners-Lee was first creating the web and URLs and HTTP and HTML, Haukam William Lee, the co-founder of Opera Software and one of the creators of CSS, he placed a bet. He placed a bet that HTML would be around in 50 years. 50 years. That's a ridiculously long timescale for a computer format. Right? If you know anything about the history of computing, you know that formats die off all the time. 50 years, a crazy timescale. Now, I think that bet actually looks pretty safe. And this is not by accident. HTML is in it for the long term by default. And also, it's got to be backwards compatible, right? Future friendly and backwards compatible. It is by design. I found an old email from Ian Hickson to a mailing list years ago. And he's talking about why he got into HTML. He's the editor of the HTML spec, the WG. And he said, the original reason I got involved in this work is that I realized that the human race has written literally billions of electronic documents, but without ever actually saying how they should be processed. I decided that for the sake of our future generations, we should document exactly how to process today's documents so that when they look back, they can still re-implement HTML browsers and get our data back. Right? That is thinking about our culture, about our society, about preserving what we're putting online. And that's kind of all I ask of you, is to think about the long web, to think about the long-term consequences of what we're doing, because I don't think we do it enough. Right? That it isn't just about what we're doing today. We are building something greater than the Library of Alexandria could ever have been. And that is an awesome, in the true sense of the word, an awesome responsibility. So you're gonna be hearing about more technologies today. You've heard about technologies yesterday, techniques, processes. And as you're evaluating all of the things you're learning over these 2 days, I want you to just think also about the longevity and the consequences and the long-term effects of what we're building, and think about the long web. Thank you.